from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Think of heroes of the Civil War. And the first faces to come to mind probably have big beards or mutton chops. My guest today, though, looks at four daring Civil War characters, liar, temptress, soldier, spy, she calls them, who were all women with stunningly bold stories, running spy rings on the battlefield dressed as men, freeing prisoners and gathering information behind enemy lines in the thick of war and espionage. This hour on Point, Civil War, women at war. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know the spying, fighting stories of Belle Boyd, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, Emma Edmonds, Elizabeth Van Leeuw? Civil War women at war. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Atlanta is Karen Abbott, author of the best-selling books Sin and the Second City, a history of Chicago's famous Everly Club brothel, and American Rose, a biography of Gypsy Rose Lee. Her new book is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Karen Abbott, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Among the many amazing things that you write about in this book, one is a number I just never focused on before and maybe never heard, that something like, I mean, you've got people, women, doing all kinds of things in all kinds of circumstances, but you remind us that something like 400 women actually put on the uniform of North or South in this war and, unbeknownst to the men around them, fought, went on to the battlefield, and they could do it in part, you tell us, because men of that time, and this may apply to your daring women as well, just couldn't imagine a woman in pants, women out doing stuff like that.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite pieces of research that I happened upon. Number one, the medical exams to get into the Army were so cursory. Official protocol dictated that everybody undergo a thorough exam, but, you know, they were desperate for numbers. They needed the recruits in quickly. So doctors flouted these rules and would just sort of tap people in the collarbone or shake their hand and just pass them along. My spy, Emmett Edmonds, who disguised herself to fight in the Union Army, the doctor merely shook her hand and said, "What sort of living has this hand earned?" And she enlisted as Frank Thompson. And as you said, nobody really suspected women were capable of doing this, of this sort of daring. And people were so used to seeing women's bodies contorted and pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes, you know, by corsets and crinolines, that the idea of a woman in pants, let alone a full Army uniform, was just unfathomable.
And then, of course, there was the fact that Emma Edmonds' story reminds us that, now, far from corsets and hoop skirts, she was out there she fought for the North in uniform, had to bring her own boots because regulation boots were too, none would fit her. But as Frank Tompkins, she went undiscovered in part because, I don't know if this was standard or just in the mayhem of war and early rising, most troops slept in their clothes. So, you know, who was to know?
Yeah, they just to save time, the drills would start so early that they would just go to bed even wearing their boots and, you know, their full coats. And so that really sort of saved her on a lot of levels. They just didn't have a lot of opportunity to see each other unclothed.
Introduce us to the others here. She's your soldier. She was the one who was actually on the battlefield and in uniform. The others, not so much. And one of a very, I think you'd have to say, hot-headed Southern rebel girl, Belle Boyd. Your book starts with her point blank shooting a Union soldier in the sitting room of her home.
Yeah, Belle Boyd was a fascinating character to me. She has no filter in any level, not, you know, for herself or for anybody around her. She was sort of all id. And she, as you said, she kicks things off by shooting a Union soldier who invades her home and threatens to raise a federal flag. And Belle was just mortally insulted by this and shoots him. And then her
this is
very
early
off
in the war when she got away with it because the Union didn't want to alienate Southerners in the Shenandoah Valley. They came around and talked about it, and she said that the soldier had insulted her mother or threatened her mother, and so off she went on her life of daring do in the Civil War.
Yeah, they were really worried about turning the 17-year-old into a Confederate martyr. And you know, she just took full advantage of this and began spying and becoming a courier for the rebel army and going on all sorts of adventures.
We'll come back and look at her tales of very wild exploits. And then you've got a couple who are, in a way, some level mirrors of one another, I guess. Rose O'Neill Greenhow in Washington, very plugged into the southern side of Washington. And Elizabeth Drew Liu in Van Liu, in Richmond, with northern sentiments, anti-slavery sentiments, even in the heart of war. Introduce us to these two.
Yeah, you're right. They were sort of exact mirror images of one another. They were both around the same age in their 40s, as opposed to Belle and Emma, who were teenagers. And Rose was a Confederate sympathizer living in Washington, D.C., so in the heart of the Union territory. And her whole life had fallen apart. She had lost 5 kids within 4 years. She lost her husband in a freak accident. She lost access to the White House. She had been a very close confidant of President James Buchanan. And all of that ended when Lincoln was elected. So she was desperate and was willing to do anything to sort of regain her position in Washington society. So when a Confederate captain approached her and said, hey, would you be willing to run a Confederate spy ring here? Rose leapt at the chance and started assembling a team of couriers, including teenagers, and, you know, hiding secret dispatches up in their hair and sending them over the lines and the skullduggery of that sort.
That was eminently doable, in part because of her, she was willing to really put herself out there, but also because, you remind us, Washington, D.C. was a deeply southern city, even after the war was well on.
Yeah, that's true. It was very southern in character, and a lot of people had come from Maryland, you know, which was a border state, and a lot of slave owners. So, and a lot of the people who, you know, all the Confederate officials who had all resigned from the federal government. So it was all sort of confused there. And Rose had access to the highest levels of government. And you know, many of her sources, whom she seduced, were federal officials. She reportedly had a very heated affair with Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. And he was one of her main sources and actually the person who inspired Alan Pinkerton, the detective, to start a case on Rose and start surveillance of her.
A woman not afraid to use her sexuality wherever it where it was required to get the information she wanted, and who played some pretty influential roles in alerting Southern generals to what was coming. But then you also take us to Richmond, where you've got her counterpart on the other side of things, very abolitionist sentiment right in the heart of the Confederacy.
Right, and where Rose was very bombastic and sort of boasted about her exploits, Elizabeth Van Liu was very discreet and quiet and cautious and cunning. She started operating a Union spy ring in the heart of the Confederacy in Richmond and recruited people from all walks of life, including a person who was a former slave of her family. Her family had owned slaves and started freeing them after her father died. Elizabeth was a lifelong abolitionist and never believed that in slavery, and got one of her family slaves placed as a spy in the Confederate White House. And of course, it was illegal to teach slaves to read or write in the South at the time, and nobody had any idea that this slave was not only literate but highly educated. Elizabeth had sent her north for an education, and she had a photographic memory. So Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, is leaving maps and around on his desk and having conversations with his advisors, and Mary Jane Bowser, which was the woman's name, was picking up on all of it and sending it back to Elizabeth.
You also remind us of the ambiguities in Virginia, even in Richmond, that many there had not been in favor of secession. And while they pretty much closed ranks publicly around the goals of the Confederacy, Elizabeth Van Liu was not entirely alone in her divided sentiments.
That's true. And luckily for Elizabeth, she had inherited quite a large sum of money and was able to use that to bribe Confederate officials, you know, the ones whose loyalties could be bought. She found them. She also placed a clerk in Richmond's largest prison, Libby, and began this practice of freeing Union prisoners and secreting them in her home and sending them over the lines, and was able to also reach the highest levels of Confederate society, just as Rose was with Union officials in Washington.
A couple of your women were famous or infamous, even during the war. They wrote about their exploits and were known at the time.
Yeah, Belle Boyd, you know, she was interesting because for somebody who purported to be a spy, she was very conspicuous and did anything she could to draw attention to herself. I like to call her sort of 19th century amalgamation of Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus.
Whoa.
she was overt with both her opinions and her sexuality. You know, she really put it out there in both her beliefs and her womanhood. And, you know, one of her teenaged rivals called her the fastest girl in Virginia or anywhere else for that matter. And she also acquired nicknames like the Siren of the Shenandoah and the Secesh Cleopatra. And she embraced all of this and really was overt about what she was doing. And that was part of her disguise. She said, well, how could somebody so brazen be dangerous? You know, I'm right out there. How dangerous could I really be? And it was very effective.
We're going to look in some depth at the amazing stories of these women. Karen Abbott writes it all up in her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Four women undercover in the Civil War. Karen Abbott joining us today from Atlanta. Today, the 150th anniversary of the capture of Atlanta by the forces of General Sherman. Songs of the Civil War here, divided and united behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Listen to the mockingbird. Listen to the mockingbird. For the mockingbird is singing o'er her grave. Listen to the mockingbird. Listen to the mockingbird. Still singing where the weeping willow waves.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bold women, daring women in the Civil War, women who took big risks, women who spied. Karen Abbott writes it all up in her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. That transfer of information, that espionage got into gear very early on. You describe how the Battle of Bull Run, Manassas Junction, as Southerners call it, may have been influenced significantly by some of what Rose Greenhow was able to send out. What was that? And how did she send it south from Washington, D.C., Karen?
Oh, this was one of my favorite stories. You know, Rose organized her spy ring, and which I had mentioned, included a bunch of teenage couriers. And she thought that they would make good scouts, as she called them. They weren't technically scouts, but she called them that, because they could pass through lines, especially if they were pretty, and Union guards would merely tip their hat and let them go through, especially early on in the war before anyone had been caught doing anything. Union guards did not suspect pretty young women of carrying confidential information like that. So Rose called over a socialite, a 16-year-old named Betty Duvall, and Rose had been, you know, quietly gathering her information from her sources, you know, having late-night rendezvous and pillow talk, and a lot of it checked out. And she had a message for Beauregard about when the Union forces were going to be moving for a first Bull Run.
Of course, it was a disaster for the Union. That information would be very helpful.
Oh, definitely. It was a disaster for the Union. You know, the Union was counting on this war to be won quickly and then move on to Richmond right from Bull Run, and it was going to be over. And Rose tied this information up in Betty Duvall's hair, sent her over to Beauregard's headquarters. Betty undid her hair, let it down, and passed it on, and the Confederates had the information they needed for that battle.
There's romance in all this as well. I it must have been one of the Confederate soldiers at the time describing, as that long hair fell down with the secrets inside. It was the hair he was thinking about.
It's true. He was mesmerized by the hair.
But then took right off for General Beauregard with that information. Take us to the origins up in Canada of Emma Edmonds' story. She wrote at some point that part of what drove her to put on the uniform and to serve was a hatred of male tyranny. But that began not in politics, but at home for her in Canada.
Yeah, she had sort of a tragic upbringing. Her father had desperately wanted a son to help out in the family farm, and her mother gave birth to all daughters except for one boy who had epilepsy. So Emma had been a disappointment. And when she reached a certain age, her father had planned for her to arrange marriage with an elderly neighbor. And Emma had seen what had happened to her older sisters, how they sort of just, married in this way, and they're just were incredibly unhappy. And Emma was determined to avoid the same sort of fate date for herself. So one night she hacks off her hair and bounds her breasts and changes into male clothing and calls herself Frank Thompson and becomes an itinerant Bible salesman and ends up in the United States, where she hears about John Brown, the abolitionist and the hanging, and starts hearing about all of the drumbeat leading up to the Civil War and decides, what part am I going to play in this great drama? You know, Emma was an abolitionist. She was also a devout Christian and did not believe in slavery, but she was just as adventurous as Belle Boyd was and wanted to a piece of that drama for herself. And so she enlisted in the Union Army in 1861.
I think a contemporary reader looking at the story of Emma, you know, spending 2 years as a cross-dressing Bible salesman before the war is going to wonder about her sexuality itself. Was this just her only escape hatch out of what she saw as a bad situation? Was she, you know, gay before the day? What?
You know, she's very coy about that, and you can understandably so. No, you know, women's diaries at the time were very, you know, do not divulge deep secrets like that very often, and use all sorts of innuendo about when talking about those things. But she does mention dating women because she didn't want her male friends to think she was queer, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And so she just sort of acted that way. But interestingly, as soon as she enlists in the Army, she falls in love with a fellow soldier. So her story immediately becomes complicated. Not only is she worrying about discovery and she's on the battlefield and dodging bullets and literally life or death situation, but she has this, romantic situation brewing, and discovery could mean arrest and charged with prostitution and being kicked out of the army. And she sort of has a dilemma. Does she keep these feelings to herself and sort of just seethe and have this bottled up inside, or does she risk it all and tell this man, her fellow soldier, how she's feeling and risk being discovered and exposed?
Did her fellow soldier, would-be lover, know that she was a woman disguised as a man?
You know, this was another great piece of research. I found his diary, and he also was a devout Christian. So most of it was talking about, you know, perfecting his relationship with God. But interspersed with that are things like, had a lovely chat with my friend Frank Thompson about religion and Jesus. But, you know, there's something really peculiar about him. I can't quite put my finger on it, but something is really interesting about Frank Thompson. And there's sort of these sorts of entries. So he knew something was up, but wasn't quite sure.
Karen Abbott's new book is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Many more than four, she reminds us, who dressed as men and went to the battlefield. Karen Abbott joins us from Atlanta. Daniel's calling right now from Nancy, Kentucky. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention Henry Kai Douglas in his book, I Rode with Stonewall. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At the Battle of Gettysburg, he talks about Jubal Early's division. They had women that were actually fighting. And after the battle, they talk about the men going to the hospital and viewing the success women.
Women who were fighting as women or disguised as men, Daniel?
They were disguised as men. They fought in with the Louisiana Tigers.
Karen, do you know the story?
I know Douglas's name. He actually met up with Belle Boyd a few times. They had known each other from childhood. And during the Battle of Front Royal in 1862, he actually sees Belle dodging bullets, running across the battlefield, intent on delivering a message to Stonewall Jackson. So that was my greatest piece of research on him. But I do remember reading that early there were women fighting around that time and with him, yes.
I mean, Daniel describes men coming to see them wounded after in the fighting. One can imagine that would be dismaying, but you know, it's not easy to stay unwounded in the Civil War. So many die and are wounded, and you would think once wounded, I mean, here you've got your Emma, a.k.a. Frank Thompson, working a lot with the wounded. Did she ever come across other women under those uniforms?
You know, she tells a story, and the self-mythologizing that went on in these memoirs, it's sort of common for the genre. And when I find a piece like this, I always make mention of it either in the endnotes or in the text itself that this was probably a little bit exaggerated. But I know that she tells a story of running into a woman on the field at Antietam, a dying wounded soldier. And Emma's regiment actually wasn't on the field at Antietam, so I knew this was just a story she was telling. But I thought it was relevant. because it's sort of, you know, it's obviously a mirror of herself. And this woman is lying by a tree, mortally wounded, and asks Emma if she could please bury her properly and respectfully, just as any other soldier would be treated, or would want to be treated anyway. They weren't properly buried, really. But to just give her a respectful send-off, and Emma said she did that.
In Emma's telling, where did her Civil War activity go from the battlefield to espionage?
It was after the execution of Timothy Webster, which was, I believe, the first spy to be executed since Hale in the Revolutionary War. And she said she was approached by her chaplain, that they had a task for her. And she went off to Washington, D.C., where she had to go another medical examination. And she was worried about this one. She thought it might be a bit more thorough. But luckily for Emma, it was mostly a phrenology examination where they just manipulated her skull and felt for the bumps.
Right.
And luckily, you know, the parts of your skull that they attributed to womanly characteristics, you know, maybe a smaller development here or a softer, you know, shape here. She fortunately, her skull felt like a man's skull for whatever reason. And she was accepted as a spy and went from there.
Let's go to Jeremiah in Clarksville, Tennessee. Jeremiah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
What I'm hearing doesn't surprise me at all. You know, women have made some major contributions since the beginning of time to wars, politics, science, medicine. I mean, just a myriad of major contributions women have made. So this, hearing about what these women done during the Civil War doesn't surprise me. In fact, I'm surprised they don't rule the world because they could. I wanted to add, I have a book. I'm Hungarian, and my folks immigrated here in 56 from Hungary, and I have a book titled Hungarians in America, and I was surprised at how many Hungarian officers they brought over here to fight in the Civil War. I don't have their names memorized, but the fact that these women did what they did in the Civil War doesn't surprise me. I mean, look at the science and medicine, and they're the mother of mankind. They've nurtured us men and babied us and took care of us and fed us and grew gardens and cooked and sold and everything. So it doesn't surprise me. I'm proud of females, you know.
Amen, Jeremiah. We're right there with you. And these are impressive stories, but among, as you point out, we could describe them among many, many. I mean, Jeremiah does raise an interesting thing that sort of your depiction of women in the Civil War breaks up our sense of a kind of monoculture there. But there were many foreigners as well. Talk about diversity. The recent immigrants were very, very well represented, and your women ran into them again and again on the battlefields.
They were sort of, you know, up against everyone. I remember when Emma started drilling in the beginning of 1861, some of the soldiers couldn't even take commands in English. So she was definitely, it was sort of a very diverse army there, and she actually tried to help those people, not only with their English commands, but also shooting. You know, there were a lot of city boys coming in, and they didn't even know how to load their rifles. So
she
Emma
was
sort
a farm
of a
girl dressed as a boy, so she had a way.
Yeah.
The way.
So she sort of took a lot of them under her wing and helped them along in that way.
Elizabeth Van Lee was very thoughtful in her abolitionism. She described slavery. She said slavery is arrogant, is jealous and intrusive, is cruel, is despotic, not only over the slave, but over the community, the state. And here's a political thinker. How did she set up her espionage activities in Richmond, Karen?
Well, she was probably in the most dangerous position of all of them. Here, you know, Richmond was this hotbed, and everybody knew, you know, that she had always had abolitionist views, and they just sort of regarded her with a wary eye. But once the war broke out, those opinions of Elizabeth's wasn't just eccentric. They were dangerous. They were dangerous for her to have these opinions. And not only that, Elizabeth was living with her little brother and his wife. His wife happened to be an ardent Confederate sympathizer. So Elizabeth starts a spy ring, you know, living under the same roof as somebody who would be all too willing to tell on her, to say what she saw, say what she overheard. So basically, you know, there's a possible Confederate spy living in Elizabeth's house as she's spying for the Union. And she starts this ring and really begins by carving out a secret room in her mansion. Well, she had a secret room and she devoted it to breaking Union prisoners out of the prisons in Richmond and putting them in there and pumping them for information and then sending them north.
How on earth did she break prisoners out? I mean, you describe her home, family home. This is a family that originally come from Pittsburgh. Her father, very successful as a with a hardware business, sold a lot to Thomas Jefferson, University of Virginia, and more. But how did she get prisoners out of a Confederate prison, went, you know, right through the streets of Richmond?
Well, she just says she had freed Mary Jane Bowser and sent her as a spy into the Confederate White House. She had freed other family slaves as well. And she stationed a lot of them around the prisons and would just have, like, they developed their own sort of network. All of these African-Americans had their own sort of network under Elizabeth in which they would speak to prisoner workers, and they would all figure out who they could trust. And she succeeded in getting a Union sympathizer placed as a clerk in Libby Prison. And so the clerk, of course, had to pretend that he was a Confederate, and he would abuse the prisoners. He would, you know, hit them with his rifle, and he would say, "Go to my office," you know, and they would all be terrified, thinking they might not come back. This guy was going to kill them. So they would go to the clerk's office. His name was Ross. And Ross would say, "Look behind that desk and see what you find." And they would look behind, and there would be a Confederate uniform there waiting for them. You know, and they quickly got what was going on and put that on. And once the prisoner made it to the outside, one of Elizabeth's freed family slaves would escort him to Elizabeth's mansion.
You've got stories here of hollowed out boot heels with messages inside, and of course wrapped in hair buns and invisible ink and photographic memories. What's the most important piece of espionage material that Elizabeth was able to find and send to Union officers?
Well, I don't know if you could pinpoint one piece. I mean, Elizabeth, you know, arguably became the most important spy of the Civil War and became undoubtedly Grant's main spy toward the end of the war. But she had been operating on her own long before that. That was one of the most sort of surprising things I learned, was how disorganized Union intelligence was. There was no overarching system whereby generals could share information until the Bureau of Military Information was formed in 1863. It was all sort of willy-nilly and slapshot and scattered. And it was only later in the war where it really solidified. So Elizabeth was on her own in the beginning and was sending valuable information, and then ratcheted up at the end with Grant, where she was sending, as you said, slaves across the lines with messages tucked in their boots. And she had a correspondence with General Butler, Beast Butler, where, you know, he would send innocuous reading letters that would say, "Dear niece, how is your darling daughter? How is the weather?" Mm-hmm. And then she would apply tannic acid and would say, "Send all information. How many troops are here? What are the positions?" So it was really sort of that cloak and dagger stuff that toward the end, that was great.
And wired right in to some very significant generals in the Civil War. Karen Abbott writes about all of it in Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Joins us today from Atlanta on this day, the 150th anniversary of the capture of Atlanta by Union troops. Behind us here, Richmond is a Hard Road to Travel. Chris Teeley and Michael Dave's Confederate song mock the defeats of Union commanders here. Teeley, of course, of Nickel Creek and Punch Brothers, and his frequent collaborator, Michael Dave's. Karen Abbott in Atlanta, please stand by. Listeners, we'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The gunboats give it up in terror and despair, for Richmond is a hard road to travel, I declare. It's Lincoln unto Pope, you can make the trip, I hope. I will save the universal Yankee nation. To make sure of no defeat, I'll leave no lines of retreat and issue a famous proclamation. But that same dreaded Jackson, this fellow laid his wax and made him by compulsion a seceder. And Pope took rapid flight from Manassas' second fight, was his very last appearance as a leader. Then pull off your coat and roll up your sleeves. Stonewall is a hard road to travel. Did his very best, but was evidently so. For Richmond is a hard road to travel, I'm told.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about bold women, daring women in the Civil War, women who took big risks, women who spied for the North and the South. Karen Abbott writes up their stories in her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Let's go to Bevan in Brattleboro, Vermont. Bevan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air with Karen Abbott.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Karen. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how and whether any of the women were honored after the war, aside from in their own inner circles. Was there any acknowledgement of the work that they've done publicly?
honored imprisoned or both. thank you, Bevan. Karen?
For a long time, the United States government denied that women soldiers fought during the Civil War, and M. Edmonds took it upon herself to change that and gain recognition. She had moved to a town in she was in Texas at the time and noticed that a lot of veterans were there and they were getting their pensions. And she, you know, here's somebody who suffered some very difficult physical wounds during the Civil War. She had quite a few hairy encounters with Confederate guerrillas and on the battlefield and did not, get out of the war unscathed and sort of was a pioneer in fighting for a pension.
We'll look at what happened with each of the four. Take us, I guess, if you would, to the sort of most daring moment of each. With Emma, where did she push it furthest in her service and espionage?
You know, Emma was interesting to me because she was so incredibly tough, but also vulnerable. And she let that vulnerability show in interesting ways. You know, number one, with her romance with Jerome. And then the next scene, she would be in a situation where she was undercover under Confederate lines. And a Confederate captain is saying, well, you have to, she was posing as a civilian. This is in Kentucky, and she's posing as a civilian. And he says, well, a young man, I believe that you should be enlisting with the Army, and I'm going to come back and recruit you for my company in the morning. And Emma goes along with this and until she's, you know, face to face with him and life or death, and pulls out her gun. And, you know, at the beginning of the war, she said, I'm not so bloodthirsty. I don't want to shoot any living man. But Emma, by the end of the war, has shot plenty of people. And this encounter was one of them. And it was pretty harrowing.
Most of her work in the medical tent, but by no means all. And the gun would come out. What about Belle Boyd? Where did she push it furthest?
You know, Belle had a temper. Belle was somebody who would just fly off the handle at any opportunity. That's it, one of her first encounters. I mean, she started a knife fight between two Confederate companies because she didn't want to sell whiskey to one of them for too cheap. She wanted a higher price for the whiskey she was selling. And a knife fight breaks out. And Belle sort of enjoyed this. She enjoyed this ruckus happening around her. But I would say her bravest moment came in spring of 1862. It was the Valley Campaign. And Belle idolized Stonewall Jackson and, you know, even told reporters that she wanted to, quote, occupy his tent and share his dangers. Oh. And Belle spent most of her time trying to get Stonewall Jackson's attention. And this was her big shining moment. She had a piece of information that she believed would save Stonewall Jackson from converging Union forces in the Shenandoah Valley in Front Royal in May 1862, and starts running onto the battlefield, you know, literally dodging bullets. She writes about how she, you know, felt them searing the hem of her skirt as she just, you know, made a beeline to Stonewall Jackson to deliver this information.
What was driving her? She was quick to anger, so maybe it was simple passion. But we heard Elizabeth Van Leeuw with her deep hatred of slavery. What drove Rose Greenhow? What drove Belle Boyd?
You know, I think what drove Rose was, as I mentioned a bit earlier, just the complete destruction of her lifestyle.
In the
this
South.
Was somebody who, mm-hmm. Yeah, in the South. You know, somebody who was in Washington, D.C., and she was the queen bee of Washington society, and that completely, with the election of Lincoln, disintegrated. And here's somebody who was even willing to use her 8-year-old daughter, which I thought was remarkable. The number of children that were involved in these espionage activities. Rose had a namesake, an 8-year-old daughter named Little Rose, mm-hmm. and she would tuck, secret encrypted dispatches in Little Rose's pantalettes and sent her out into the yard. And Rose's scouts would come by at an appointed time and take the message and maybe give another message back to Rose. And she was willing to risk her daughter for this cause.
She called them scouts in part because, maybe to soothe them, they weren't scouts. They were scouts, if they were found out, would be imprisoned as regular soldiers. Spies would be killed.
Scouts are actually members of the military.
Right.
Spies were civilians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the scout would be summarily hanged, and the civilian would, just go on trial. They were handled differently.
What was her greatest triumph of espionage? Was it Bull Run or later?
Well, Bull Run was certainly the thing that really made a name for herself, literally. I mean, Rose became a national name after that. And, of course, I had mentioned Alan Pinkerton. She got on his radar. And one of my favorite scenes was Alan Pinkerton and two of his detectives in a ridiculous downpour staking out Rose's house on Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. And Pinkerton standing on the shoulders of two of his detectives to try to get a peek into her window. And what does he see but Rose sitting on the sofa with a traitor Union captain who's showing her maps of Union fortifications and troop positions. And then they start passionately kissing and you know, Pinkerton is seething. And that just sort of makes Rose public enemy number one. But Rose, of course, also was sent to Europe to lobby on behalf of the Confederacy, which was a really unprecedented move. You know, women had never been sent abroad to represent their government in an official capacity like that.
She was a very sophisticated woman and bold. Daniel in Westerlo, New York. Daniel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What's your question?
I just had a quick comment. A very short story about a fantastic woman in my life, which ties in directly to this book. Amazingly so. My grandmother was the family historian, told us all the stories being related to Kit Carson and this and that and all the other thing. As I'm sitting here listening to the story, something she had told us our whole lives came up was that we had a relative in Libby Prison, who walked out pretending to be a Confederate soldier.
Oh wow!
Kind of amazing.
Maybe he hid out in the attic of our of our spy here today.
It's quite possible. Yeah.
Incredible. Her place was just a few blocks from the prison, or one of the big prisons.
Yeah,
there?
It was in walking distance of Libby, you know, not at all too far, especially if you're wearing a Confederate uniform and you know, disguised appropriately. And, you know, she lived in Church Hill, which was the wealthiest neighborhood, the most respected neighborhood. You know, people frequently invited soldiers in for a bite to eat. So, you know, just a Confederate soldier walking into your home would be no cause for suspicion.
And what did she do with her hidden room in the upper eaves of her home?
Well, she had two nieces, you know, and it was great. Some of the information came from interviews her nieces gave later, talking about how they would watch their aunt, assemble the uniforms and present passports and paperwork to get them up north. Once they got up north, they had paperwork to get themselves jobs, and she told them where to go and who to report to. So the nieces talk about just watching their aunt gather all this information and sort of fretting. And, you know, one of the nieces went up to the secret room and peeked in when Elizabeth wasn't around, and the man put his finger to his lips and says, please, you know, don't tell anybody we're here. We're all going to die if you do. So it was pretty dramatic there.
Stakes were high. Carrie in Dalton, Georgia. Carrie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Miss Abbott, did any of the four women that you're speaking of go on to any great significance after the war, or just simply fade into history?
Well, Elizabeth was appointed postmaster of Richmond, which was, you know, one, I think the highest federal position a woman could get at the time, and was, you know, said a lot that Grant gave her that. And Elizabeth really tried to reform that position. She hired a lot of women and for the post office and a lot of African Americans and sort of became a feminist. She would send in a note of protest every time she paid her property taxes, saying this is taxation without representation.
Because women were not voting in those years.
Right, of course. And Elizabeth was, you know, really sadly ostracized in her later years. You can imagine that once Richmond found out this is Ulysses S. Grant's most important spy, they were not too keen on socializing with her on any level.
Was she found out ever during the war? Some were.
Somewhere, Elizabeth was not. There was always suspicion. In fact, one of my, you know, I thought it was really interesting the way women were able to hide behind the idea of female gentility. And their gender was a psychological disguise. You know, Confederate detectives would come in and search her home. And what did Elizabeth do? But march right down to the Richmond Provost Marshal and say, how dare you send your detectives to my home to accuse me of being in league with the enemy? Such conduct is unbecoming of an officer and a gentleman, and it's an insult to unprotected ladies. And of course, you know, she's the furthest thing from an unprotected lady, mm-hmm. and just sort of turning her words back on her accusers and hiding behind that idea that women were not capable of this sort of treasonous behavior.
Pinkerton looking on in Washington as Rose Greenhow had her passionate embrace, she was found out.
Yes.
What happened with her? How did she end up in Europe after being found out in Washington?
Well, Rose was, you know, they didn't quite know what to do. I mean, this was something that the government never had to grapple with before. Of course, there were female spies in the Revolutionary War, but none of them were outspoken about it. None of them talked about what they were doing. They certainly weren't hot-headed and really explicit about their behavior like Rose Greenhow was. And there was a great quote where one Lincoln official says, "What do we do with these, quote, fashionable women spies?" And it was just this new idea. You know, women were supposed to be victims of war, not its perpetrators. And the idea that women waged war, even more deftly than men, was something that was unthinkable to them. So they didn't quite know what to do with Rose Greenhow. And they imprisoned her and a bunch of her female accomplices in her home in Washington, D.C., and called it Fort Greenhow. And this is until she had to go to an actual prison with her 8-year-old daughter in tow for a while and until they decided what they should do with her.
Which, I guess, was exile to the South, which the South put her to work across the Atlantic.
Right. They Jefferson Davis thought, you know, since the beginning of the war, he and his advisors had been trying to gain legitimacy in the eyes of Europe. You know, if only England and France would recognize the Confederacy, it would be a great boon for them in the war and would get, you know, put them at odds with the United States, with the North. And so they sent Rose over there as a sort of last-ditch effort to try to lobby Europe and gain recognition for the Confederacy. And Rose had some grand adventures, you know, meeting with Napoleon III and various other dignitaries and trying to fight for her cause overseas.
Zero lack of ambition here. Mara in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Mara, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just read not long ago that there was a Lady Pinkerton. She was the first Pinkerton woman. And yeah. She was hired by the agency. When she came into the office, she wanted work, and he thought that she wanted secretarial, but she wanted... Anyways... when Lincoln was first inaugurated, he had to travel from Springfield, Illinois to Washington, and he went by a circuitous route. Pinkerton himself, through various loops, found out that there was going to be a very probable attempt on his life at Baltimore. So what they did was they changed his train schedule so that he went on a different train at night. He disguised himself by not wearing his enormous top hat. He wore a slouch mm-hmm. hat and a long overcoat type thing. And the Pinkerton lady had already purchased 2 tickets for them, and he was to be known as her brother. So when the train pulled off in a small town, he made the transfer from the regular train he was on to this other train and let in to her car, sleeping car, because he was her brother.
That's kind of amazing when you think what it took just to get to Washington. If that's true, Karen, there's Pinkerton acknowledging the special capacity of women, maybe given the psychological disguise they were capable of in that time.
Oh, definitely. And the caller was referring to Kate Warren, who was indeed a Pinkerton operative and widely recognized as the first female detective in the country. And Pinkerton hired a lot of female detectives on his force. He recognized the sort of, and in fact, he said that women could make better spies in some ways, which was interesting. And there was a woman named Hattie Lawton who he employed in Richmond, and she was involved with Timothy Webster, the spy who was eventually executed. Excuse me. But the interesting thing about Pinkerton was that he was so short-sighted. He failed to recruit spies already in Richmond. You know, he would send his own people, men and women, down there as interlopers and try to infiltrate the Richmond society and Richmond government. But he never thought to maybe make contact with people who were already living there, who were Union sympathizers. So, I mean, he missed a great opportunity in contacting Elizabeth Van Loo. He never touched base with her extensive Richmond underground, as she called her operation. So it was a major failure of intelligence on Pinkerton's part there.
A couple of these women were not shy about self-mythologizing. They had their own memoirs. How did you, as an historian, sort out, you know, their own self-mythologizing from fact?
Well, I try to, whenever possible, check their accounts against someone else's. And I did that especially in the case of Belle Boyd, shooting the Union soldier at the beginning of the war. There were actually diary entries of men saying, "Belle Boyd claims she shot a Union soldier. I think she's the only one who really believes that." But there were newspaper reports of a man, of a Union soldier being buried shortly thereafter that really tied to that situation. And also several diary accounts of Belle's behavior and the action during that time. So, you know, there was enough of corroboration there. And it went on, and, you know, I tried to check those accounts, and any time that they exaggerated, I tried to take a look at it and say why. And what they were exaggerating was sort of just as important to me as what they actually did. You know, why was this important for them to highlight? And so I tried to look at it that way.
We all have the image of the woman who was left alone at home on the farm. There were many women who played key roles here, not on the battlefield, but at home, keeping life and limb together as the war went on. But you take us right out to this sort of edgiest edge of where these women were. Does it change your sense of the war?
It did. You know, I think women wholeheartedly transformed women's roles in society during the Civil War. It was nothing was the same afterward for them. Everything from the home front to marriage roles to romantic relationships to work life. It was all completely transformed during these full 4 years.
Karen Abbott takes us right out to that edge in her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Karen, thanks very much for being with us this hour. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And thanks for all our music this hour from the album Divided and United, Songs of the Civil War, here, The Battle Cry of Freedom. Popular on both sides in the Civil War. Here's the instrumental version by Brian Sutton. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.